Well, tonight we're going to go to the book of Daniel. My sons wanted to know if I would actually be in Daniel, in our study in Daniel, and I assured them that we would. So we are going to be in Daniel, first chapter of Daniel, tonight. Daniel consists of 12 chapters. I know that seems like a profound observation. But you can divide it up into basically right down the middle into really two types of literature. The first six chapters gives us details of Daniel and his friends' lives as captives in Babylon and the struggles and the challenges that they faced there. Now, the last six books of Daniel are pretty much composed of prophecy that was revealed to Daniel during Belshazzar's reign. And Belshazzar, as we saw last time, he was the last Babylonian king to rule in Babylon. And the prophecies went all the way through King Cyrus, who was the king of Persia, who came down and overthrew Belshazzar, basically took the city of Babylon without a fight. So my intention over the next several times is to speak through the book of Daniel, the next several times that I'm speaking, so it'll take a good little while, but we'll get through the book of Daniel. We probably won't do a lot of study in the prophetic chapters, but we'll look at chapters 1 through 6 and then conclude in chapter 12, just to give you an overview of where we're headed. The last two times we spoke, we looked at what I call the backstory of Daniel, and we looked at some scripture in Jeremiah and also some work from historians that lived back then or not shortly after the time of Babylon and what they recorded in history as far as who took over who and who defeated who and the different battles that took place at the time. In the future, we are going to be using the books of Jeremiah, Nehemiah, and Ezra to add some more emphasis on what is going on during this time period that Daniel is in Babylon along with his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as we better know them. But tonight, we're going to get a glimpse of one of the first challenges that was faced by Daniel, as seen in chapter 1. Now, Daniel is taken to a land where everything familiar is taken away from him, if you look at it from that point of view. Now, he's in a new culture, so the language would not be familiar to him. His family was no longer with him, so that would not be familiar with him. He was on his own. His freedom to worship would be taken away from him as well. And we'll see that even his name is taken away from him. All the things that were familiar in his life are being removed from him one by one. Now, it's often when we study a chapter in the Bible that we find a key verse or a verse that a lot of the other verses tie into. And one of my favorite verses in the first chapter of Daniel is verse 8. And it says, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself." It's probably one of the most famous verses in that first chapter. The New American Standard says that Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself. I think you will see that everything prior to verse 8 brings us into that verse to set the scene for Daniel to take a stand, not to defile himself. And everything that falls after verse 8 in this chapter is a result of him taking a stand not to defile himself with the food of the king. But before we look at that entirety of chapter 1, I just want to talk a little bit about what does it mean to purpose in your heart? What does it mean to come to a decision in some translations or to make up your mind? You know, the same thought is in Job. You don't have to turn there, but it's in Job chapter 5, verse 8. This is one of Job's friends. I know you might not call them their friends because of how they attacked him. But anyway, Job's friends, Eliphaz, said this in 5:8, "But as for me, I would seek God, and I would place my cause before God." I would place my cause before God. I'm going to place before God what I'm going to do. Now, the Hebrew word here means to commit oneself to do something. To commit oneself to do something. It's a very strong word. You're committing yourself before God, with God as your witness, that you are going to do this. And that's what it means, to purpose in your heart, or to purpose, in your mind, or to make up your mind. In Esther, it's a very similar situation. When she was asked by Mordecai to make a plea before the king. In Esther 4:16, she says, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." You know, you get the impression that this was a decision that was made to stick. Regardless of what happened, she was going to go through with this. She had purpose in her heart. She had said in her mind that this is what she was going to do. So Daniel, very similarly, has made the same decision. He's purpose in his heart that no matter what happens, he's going to keep himself from eating the king's food and defiling himself. You know, if it meant starving to death, I have to think that he was okay with that. You know, if it meant being cast into a fiery furnace, I think he was okay with that. If it meant being tossed into a cave with a bunch of hungry lions, Daniel would have been okay with that. We know that just from his friend's experience and from his as well. He had made a commitment to God that he would not defile himself. You know, we never see a time in his life when he wavered from that commitment to God, that commitment to live a godly life. You know, I have to ask myself when I'm studying Daniel, you know, am I prepared, how much am I prepared to lose to do something that I've set my mind upon? How much am I prepared to lose to take a stand for God? Maybe I should put it this way. What have I set my mind on today that I'm willing to die for, or to maybe be tortured for, or to suffer some other disease or something for? You know, Lord willing, this is a poor example, but Lord willing, my family and I will be running a 5K Friday, not this Friday, a week from Friday, including our dog. And so, you know, I purposed in my heart that I'm going to finish this thing, and not only am I going to finish it, but I'm going to do it in under 30 minutes. Right? That's what I purposed in my heart and my mind, and I am very, very strong-willed. So what am I prepared to do in order to meet that? You know, am I willing to run if it's raining and you know, sleet or whatever, freezing temperatures? Am I going to run just as hard? Yeah, I'm going to do that, you know. Well, if I start to cramp up in my side and maybe my calf starts to tense up or some, you know, well, I keep running to get that 30 minutes. Yeah, I'll do that. You know, short of, you know, something falling off, or, you know, my leg breaking. You know, if Jer's there whining beside me, you know, will I keep the press on? Yeah, I can guarantee it. You know, but if Jer falls down and he needs my help, am I willing to keep going and leave him there in order to get that 30 minutes? And, you know, you have to make that decision before the race. And I've told him, Jer, if you fall, I'm going. You know, so because I know that my wife is going to be behind me. And she'll tend to him, and Humphrey will lick his face and help him to recover. You know, obviously, you know, we need to make a decision before we're faced with that circumstance. What are we prepared to do? Well, how far are we prepared to go? You know, we can't or should not compromise certain things in our lives. And we need to decide beforehand, before we're faced with that, you know, what we are unwilling to compromise. You know, as a, you know, this is not just young people, but as a young person, or even as an older person, you need to decide before you're faced with that opportunity whether you're going to go out and drink with your buddies. You know, to wait until the time when they come and say, make that decision, is not a good time to make that decision. You know, you need to decide before that little window pops up on your computer if you're going to visit a pornographic site or not, because it's going to happen sooner or later if you're on the internet. You know, it's too late to decide when you begin your life in college and mom and dad are no longer there, how you're going to live your life, how you're going to be a testimony to God. You know, it's too late, even for us older men. Older ladies, when a pretty girl smiles or winks at you, what your reaction is going to be? You have to decide beforehand and know that you're not going to compromise your testimony. It's a simple concept, but I find it very hard to master. You know, we see in Daniel's life that he purposed at an early age that he would not defile himself. And that was not just for food. You'll see throughout his life that he will not defile himself concerning anything, whether it's prayer or whether it's anything concerning his testimony. I shared this verse the last couple of times we spoke. And it's Timothy 4, 7, the end of verse 7 into verse 8. Says, train yourself for godliness, for while bodily training is of some value, godliness is of value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. Now, with those thoughts in mind, we're going to begin reading Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. It's the story of a man who lived a godly life. The book of Daniel is. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Now, we looked at last time how King Nebuchadnezzar had captured Jerusalem. He left King Josiah's son on the throne as basically a figurehead. King Josiah's son was to collect tribute and send it to Nebuchadnezzar on a regular basis. Now, Nebuchadnezzar removes part of the treasures from the temple, and he takes them and he puts them in the treasury of one of the temples of his God, really as trophies to his conquering of Jerusalem. Now, I had this map up here. Just wanted to show you the route in which they took one more time. You know, it's only 500 miles from Jerusalem to Babylon over here. So it seems like this would be the easier way to go rather than going all the way up here and down. It's about 900 miles to go that way. But if you look at that and look at these little words right here, the Arabian Desert. You ever see Lawrence of Arabia? It's not a pleasant place to be or to try to cross. And so what they would do, they would follow the rivers up through here, cross over to the Euphrates, and follow the Euphrates River down to Babylon. It was a long trip, probably about 5 months for Nebuchadnezzar's army and the captives to go. You know, he arrives in Babylon. He's got a few of these captives in tow. He has these treasures from the temple. He places them in the treasure house of his God. And then he does something that I find very interesting. In verse 3, it says, the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and other nobles. Now, he's asked the head of all his advisors. So this would be like his second in command. I mean, he would be, well, the top guy other than him that would report to all the others that he was over. So he was chief of his officials. And he's asked for him to select some young men. In verse 4, it says, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So Ashpenaz has a pretty... I would say awesome task to do. And I'm going to show you how this is going to work. I'm just going to have these two tables right here. If y'all guys would stand up. These two tables. Yep, y'all back there too. All right. Now, if you don't meet the qualifications, I'm going to have you sit down. All right, you've got to be male. All right. So these represent the captives that were taken. Nowhere in the Bible does it say the captives were all youth. And they were all men or women. They would have taken the prime that Jerusalem had to offer at that time. All right, now you need to be probably, this is very subjective, but it was a youth. Someone says child, but we could say you need to be between the ages of, let's say, 13 and 16. Between 13 and 16. Okay, wow. Well, we're weeding them out pretty quick, aren't we? All right, now you had to be physically fit. All right? Come on. We don't have to see you. Come on. Get back up. That just, you know, You may not be much to look at right now, but you will be. All right, come on, stand up, Jer. Physically fit. All right. Had to be good looking. Had to be good looking. And we didn't even get to intelligent and wise. I was going to ask some questions. And they had to be able to conduct themselves in a manner in which they would not bring shame to the king and his court. You know, in the words of one of my sons, no bottom breathing. You know, couldn't do any bottom breathing in the presence of the king and the court. Those of you who don't know what that is, you can ask Josiah. He's the one that brought that up at Mountaintop years ago. So you had to not do anything that would bring shame to the king. Now, how he was able to do that, I have no idea. If I was given that task and I had, 50 or 60 people, how could I weed them out? Obviously, you'd have to sit down and ask them questions. Maybe you had a questionnaire you filled out. Maybe you had a talent show and they would march by and tell about themselves and you would choose them out. But I believe that God had his hand on Ashpenaz because he was able to pick out of, you know, we don't know about the rest of the guys, but we do know that he picked Daniel and he picked, I'm going to not get their names correct, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they're better known for. He picked these four guys as part of these that turned out to be the best of the best. And we'll see why they turned out to be that way. Now, you know, not all the captives of Jerusalem were going to be in this school for young, gifted Jewish boys. Okay, it was just a select few. It may have only been a dozen. We don't know how many, but it wasn't all the captives that were brought over. They were handpicked by the chief of King Nebuchadnezzar's officials, Ashpenaz. Verse 5 says, the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Why do you think the king would want to have young boys from a foreign country to serve him? You know, some commentators said maybe they wanted to seduce them and to win over their hearts and to have them in turn win over the hearts of the other Jews when they came. Some think that maybe they were being trained and learned the language so that they could communicate with the Jews that would come later from Babylon. You know, maybe, and I kind of think this might be the most logical explanation, maybe it was like those treasures that King Nebuchadnezzar bought from the temple. And he took them and placed them in the temple of his gods. You know, maybe he brought these young men and he wanted to train them up and as treasures. You know, look what the Babylonians were able to do with our great knowledge and our great teachers. We were able to take these Jewish boys and train them to be able to serve in the king's court. You know, it reminds me a little bit of the movie My Fair Lady. Anybody see that? I thought of this as an illustration. See, it's not going to work. Has anybody in these two tables seen My Fair Lady? The older lady at the end has seen My Fair Lady. Well, you need to rent the movie because there's Henry Higgins. He's this very gifted man who's able to. He's not a ventriloquist, but he's a speech therapist. Okay, there we go. Has to do with speaking. Anyway, so he takes this girl, Eliza Doolittle, who can't speak or conduct herself nicely at all, is putting it mildly, and he trains her to be a noble. Very noble woman who is able to conduct herself good in the presence of a king and other nobles. You know, he trains her how to speak and how to walk and how to eat and what conversation to have. And in the end, I mean, it's just amazing. But his motivation for doing it, because, you know, he's got a bet with a friend of his that he can take any terrible person that has no couth and no manners and no abilities, that he can take the lowest of the low and he can elevate them up and make something out of them to glorify himself, you know. And I think that's what King Nebuchadnezzar was trying to do. I think he was taking these boys and training them and putting them in his court so that when those came to pay him homage, he could say, look what I've done for these young boys. Look at the people or the men that I have turned them into. I think they were his trophies. But not only did the king provide these young men with education, he provided them with food. And not just any food, it was the best food that he could give them. Now, unlike many commentators, I really don't believe that he was trying to intentionally corrupt them with very succulent foods. The word that's used here, I know it says meat in the King James, but it's just a generic word for food. And the king, at that point, he would have had meals that would consisted of vegetables and meat. Now, we know that these Jewish boys, a lot of them were nobles, and they were from the king's family, and the Israelites pretty much would have the same type of food. They ate meals of vegetables and breads and meats, but the meats were only for the nobles. There was really only two classes, or what, in the middle class. So the lower class pretty much lived off of vegetables because they used the animals to they used the sheep. They didn't eat them because they got the wool from the sheep. They got milk from the goats, or they would sell them for meat for their income. So, you know, these boys would have been used to, most likely, eating fine foods because of the families in which they came from. So I think Nebuchadnezzar just wanted to offer them the best food that he could give them so that they would grow strong, and they would, again, be the trophies that he would want to display in his court. But it says, with the verse that we started out with, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials, Ashpenaz, that he might not defile himself. Well, how did Daniel know that these foods would defile him? You know, there were many explanations given, if you look at commentators, at how he could have known, but I found one that I think that makes the most sense, and it just really has to do with the Babylonian culture. In their culture, they worshiped many gods, and they would have temples set up, and they would have many gods that would be carved out of wood. Wood was a commodity that you didn't find in Babylon because there weren't trees there in the desert for the most part. So they would be carved out of wood. They'd be adorned with gold and precious stones and really nice cloths and clothing. They'd be decked out in these temples. Well, I know it sounds crazy, but these gods were brought food on a daily basis. It was the best food that those who worked in the temples could prepare, and they would bring them plates of vegetables and meats and all that were cooked and prepared for them for their dining pleasure. All right, well, not only did they bring dishes for these idols, they brought extra dishes for gods that might be coming to visit with these gods during mealtime. So they would sit out, you know, there would be plates for all those they think that might be coming to dine with the gods. Well, when the meal was over, I don't know how they determined that, but when the meal was over, the plates were collected and they were taken to the king and his courts, and then they would eat that. So they would eat the leftovers that were left over from the gods. Now, I doubt there was a day that the king and his court ever went hungry because the plates were empty. Now, it was because of this that I believe that Daniel would have refused to eat the food. Not because of how it was prepared, but who it was had been prepared for. You know, they were eating food. The king was eating food that the gods had left over for them in their generosity. And so they would thank the gods for, you know, thank you for not eating all your food today and allowing me to eat the rest of it. So for good reason, I think David refused in his heart to eat this food. And he had to come up with a plan at this point for him and his three friends to not to defile themselves. So in verse, let's look at verse, where are we now? I think we're in 8. All right, we just read 8. Okay. All right, so rather than simply refuse the food, Daniel comes up with a plan to do something different. And he seeks permission from the man that signed him up for this gifted young Jewish boys class. And in verse 9, it says that God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. Oh, at the end of verse 8, it says he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. So he goes to Ashpenaz, and he asks him, you know, do I have to eat this food? I can't eat it. You know, what I believe is that if I eat this food, that I will defile myself, and I cannot do that. So he goes and asks him. Now, it says here that God had granted Daniel favor with this man. And he even says in the King James that there was a love between him and Daniel because he recognized through God that this was a very gifted and a very special young lad. But even though the commander of the officials liked him greatly, he was not willing to lay his life on the line for Daniel. Verse 10 says, "And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, 'I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king.'" You know, if you were reading through that, that wouldn't have been the answer that I would have expected to have gotten. All right? Here was a man that said that God had granted favor with and compassion. But yet he turned him down. Yeah, he turned him down. So what does Daniel do? Oh, well, I tried. You know, I'm not willing to starve to death. We'll eat it anyway, and God will forgive me, and we'll move on. And maybe he'll use me to do something else for him. No, he doesn't. You know, and you have to recognize and realize that this is a young man without the benefit of his parents, without the benefit of elders telling him what to do. And so he goes and he approaches someone else. He approaches the man that Ashpenaz, the commander of the officials, has placed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he lays out his plan to him instead. So, you know, these four young boys have been assigned this man probably as a tutor and as their caretaker for this three-year period of training. And Daniel goes to him instead in verse 11. It says, "But Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, 'Please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearances be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see.' So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days." You know, as I read that, I thought, well, what's the difference between this man and the commander of the officials? You know, I think, you know, the commander of the officials, his job was to prepare these boys for the king. And so he delegated down to this other man that was probably their teacher and tutor, caretaker over those four boys. We don't see that he is assigned to anybody other than Daniel and his three friends. You know, you see Daniel lay out his request very carefully. When I saw or read how Daniel did this, you know, I thought immediately of Lois, who has that scientific mind. And if you're going to do a test, you know, you've got to set certain boundaries, right? And so, you know, the first part of the test, Daniel said, "We're just going to eat vegetables and water. Vegetables and water." You know, I'm sitting there. It gets worse than that, guys. I mean, 10 days, and if it works, it's going to be for 3 years, right? Vegetable and water for 3 years, and we'll see why your other friends are eating the king's choice food. But you'll see it was a good choice to make. Again, you know, Daniel has purposed in his heart not to defile himself no matter what the cost. All right? Imagine you were given the choice of carrot sticks or pizza, you know, for 3 years. Okay? It's a choice you need to make before you're presented with it, because on an empty stomach, you know, the pizza is going to look pretty good. So he picks a duration. He has to set a duration of time. It's a controlled experiment. You just can't say, well, let's I don't know, a couple months, 6 months. I don't know. What do you think? You know, it's going to be long enough. We're not really told who this guy's name, but he's their caretaker, teacher, perhaps, and tutor. But Daniel sets it at 10 days, very specific. Vegetables and water, 10 days. Well, what's the evidence going to be? It's going to be their countenance, their outward look, you know, how they look. You know, wow, could 10 days? I'm thinking about my wife and I trying this at home with our boys. Vegetable and water for 10 days and just see how much better they look. at the end of 10 days, and if that works out okay, we'll just keep them on that diet until they leave home. Sounds like a pretty good plan. 10 days. Well, if you're going to have any experiment going on, what else do you have to have? A control group. A control group. I actually had that written. Control group. Thought of Lois when I did this. And the control group is the rest of the youth in the program. So he's got it laid out like a perfect scientist. I mean, this is a brilliant kid, right? And I think the reason that this guy agreed to it, he's probably a scientist too, and he's probably thinking, wow, this is a good opportunity to check out this hypothesis. Is that what you call it? Theory or a hypothesis that the vegetables and the water is better than the king's choice food? So he agrees to it. You know, what did he have to lose? 10 days. I can do that. Verse 15. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. Now, obviously, this was a miracle because we were not intended to eat vegetables alone. God has worked a miracle here in these young boys' life, and they are fatter and look better than all the rest of them. So the overseer, it doesn't say go and do likewise. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine that they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. Well, the results were conclusive, not inconclusive. They were conclusive. The vegetable water diet was a better diet than those eating the special king's food. You know, when I've read this many times, I think I read it too fast, I always assumed that all the rest of those guys that were eating the king's choice food had to eat the same thing. Well, you don't read that. And I don't think they did, because you see that the blessing is only for those four. You know, it says the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. It's very possible that neither the king nor Ashpenaz ever knew that this was going on in those 3 years, that's what they were eating. But as a result of their faithfulness, as a result of their desire not to defile themselves, as a result of purposing in their heart early on not to defile themselves, it says in verse 17, as for these four youths, doesn't say any more than four, it says God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom, and Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. You know, because of their faithfulness to God here, God blessed them. He blessed them just as he blessed Solomon in giving him great wisdom, knowledge, and intelligence. You know, in addition, Daniel's given the ability to be able to interpret dreams, which is going to come in very handy. We'll see in a few chapters. You know, but is obedience to God a guarantee of God's blessing in your life? If you obey God and all that he asks you to do, if you purpose in your heart not to defile him or to destroy your testimony, is God going to bless you with wisdom and... Something to think about. But I would say no. That just because you're obedient to God doesn't mean he's going to bless you like he blessed them, right? And the reason I can say that is that we see later on when Daniel's friends were obedient to God and they were thrown into the fiery furnace, what did they say? You know? Yeah, but if not. You know, there was no guarantee that God would deliver them. You can look through the Bible and there's example after example of godly men, of prophets, the ones that were sawn in two and stoned to death. They were obedient to God, but it cost them their life. They weren't blessed here, but they received their blessing, obviously, later. So obedience to God does not necessarily mean an earthly blessing, but it does mean a heavenly blessing. Verse 18. Then at the end of the days, when the king had specified which the king had specified for presenting them. So this is at the end of the three-year period. The commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one, was found like Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. That's a big test. Has anybody here got a master's, doctorate? Okay. You know, if you're a master's student or doctorate, you have a thesis to defend, and you have to go before a board of very knowledgeable people. And they're going to ask you all kinds of questions, and you've got to defend your thesis and do so in a way that they are satisfied that you know what you're talking about and you're not just trying to bluff your way through it. You know, this was very much, I think, similar to that. I would have been extremely nervous. You know, here they're going to appear before the king. They've been training for this for 3 years. They're going to appear before the king, and he's going to talk with them. He's going to question them. He's going to find out what they know. So how does it go? Well, you know, they probably didn't have to worry because we read back in verse 17 that God gave them knowledge and intelligence and every branch of literature and wisdom. And so they had already been gifted with all of that before they had to appear before the king. So they probably slept well the night before, unlike the rest of the special Jewish captive group. Verse 20 and 21. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, it says every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them twice as good than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. No. What? 10 times. 10 times. I don't think that's just an expression. You know, I think they were that much better. 10 times better than all the magicians, conjurers who were in his realm. And Daniel continued into the first year of Cyrus the king. You know, being the fact that they were gifted by God, who knows all things, understands all things. It said that Solomon, you know, was the wisest man on the earth at that time. People came to him just to ask him questions, and he could answer whatever they asked him. But do you think they used that as an advantage to glorify themselves? That would be a dangerous gift to have. It'd be a you know, if I have a car problem, I go to Mr. Tom and he answers a question for me, right? Not every time. But if he could do it every time, that would be a dangerous gift to have, because pretty soon he would be puffed up. You know, but thankfully, we're not like that. But these guys were 10 times better, but yet they continued to live out their life in a way in which would honor the Lord. 10 times better. I wrote that godly wisdom, knowledge, and intelligence is 10 times better than that of man. All right? Case in point. You know, given all of man's wisdom and knowledge that we possess, science has determined that life created itself, that we came out of a cesspool, that we were descendants of the apes, and that those who believe in God is just a crutch for the weak-minded. You know, that's man's wisdom. I would say God's wisdom is 10 times better and probably far above that. I think 10 is probably a conservative number. Than man's wisdom. And God's wisdom is hundreds of times more wise. So I'm thankful and been challenged with this chapter about two things. One is, you know, what am I doing, you know, with the wisdom and knowledge that God has given me concerning not doing my job as much as in His Word. And the other thing is the purpose, you know, in my heart. How and what I'm going to react to things in the future when faced with it. I think that we can be pretty certain that times are going to get more difficult. And things are going to happen here at the chapel that we're going to be challenged with that we need to make the decision now how we're going to react, and regardless of what the penalty might be. That's Daniel chapter 1. Next time we speak, we'll be into chapter 2, and after that, we'll continue on to 3, 4, and 5, and 6, and 12 is the plan. So thank you for coming out tonight, for hearing what